Well, hello. This is another podcast from Books of the Year.
Yes, it is. Yes, you were slightly thrown there. Why on earth are we here? I don't know.
No. I can see the Matt Haig book, so I know we're going to talk to Matt Haig.
Yeah.
And it's a book.
It is a book,
and
that's true.
And he writes about books an awful lot.
Yeah.
So that means it's another episode of Books of the Year. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Matt will be with us very shortly, apparently, but he's just around the corner.
Just around the corner, is he? Yeah, just coming now, yeah.
Gaynor Frostick says, hi both. Firstly, a little aside. Yes, Matt, I'm Nancy's mum.
Oh, Nancy Frostrick, yes.
So, she's told me lots about you, but don't worry, your secrets are safe with me.
Right, so Nancy was one of the... I've stepped away from William Hill this year, but I think she's still involved in the William Hill Sports Book of the Year Award.
Oh, right.
So Nancy's one of the other judges. Okay. Hello to Nancy.
Now then, down to business. I wanted to say a massive thank you for recommending The Echo Chamber by John Boyne.
Mm.
I devoured it in a couple of sittings, and it's going to be tricky to beat, hilarious, addictive, and so realistic. The characters were just so much fun. This is a while back now.
Yeah, it is a while, yeah.
I've just rediscovered my local library and picked this book up from the shelves. When I began to read it, a little note slipped out of the book. It said, "This is brilliant, but unlike his usual books, you might be surprised."
Oh, is that good? Unlike his usual books, so they're saying it's brilliant, but not like his other books are brilliant.
Yes. Okay. I love this idea. I'm going to note bomb books from now on. Thanks again. And for the banter that you both have on the podcast, it's all appreciated, Gaynor Frostick. So I guess it all depends what the note is.
Yes.
By all means, leave notes at the library if they're pleasant.
Yeah.
Or vague enough not to be a spoiler. But,
Obviously, don't say,
well, on page 31, it's obvious that it was Brian who did it.
Yeah. Would you ever leave one that said, "I wouldn't bother"? Would you ever?
No, that's pretty spiteful.
That's wrong.
I remember as a kid, though, I did actually, it was an Agatha Christie, and it had a cast of characters at the beginning.
Oh, no.
And I did underline
You underlined the murderer, didn't you?
I did.
Brilliant.
But I was like 10 or something like that. Anyway.
Right, an email from Steve. Dear Simon and Matt, thanks for the great pod. I enjoy listening in the car when making my weekly commute from Oxford to Reading. Recently, I have got into classical music. I'm by no means an expert, but was keen to have a greater knowledge than just The Four Seasons. Since my new exploration into this genre, I've been putting on some light classical in the background while reading. Mm-hmm. I've never done this before. I've always read in silence, but I have to say I'm quite enjoying it. Soft strings work the best, I find. Piano-led pieces, no good.
Oh, okay.
Do you ever read with music on, says Steve Pence?
I do usually, yes. I've done a lot of like classical in my time.
Mm-hmm.
I like stuff like Max Richter, who is also kind of gentle piano music. He's perfectly fine. I also have a Mozart, which is like I have a Mozart playlist, which is like 24 hours of Mozart.
Wow,
which is
24 hours. Did he produce 24 hours worth of music?
Oh, yeah, and the rest.
Really?
Yeah, like a week's worth, probably.
Goodness.
But stuff without vocal normally. So instrumental stuff would be...
Yeah, you've got to have no vocals, yeah. I've only just recently started doing it when I'm reading the papers on a Sunday, is putting classical music on to make myself feel sophisticated. And
do you smoke a Gauloise?
Smoking Gauloise, having an espresso, all of that. But yes, no, I'd agree. The problem is that I put it on to, not quite as classy as everyone else, I just put it onto Apple Music and go, shuffle, anything classical, I don't care. Trouble is quite a lot of adverts come up. As in music from adverts. And I'm like, oh, it's the Lloyd's Bank thing.
Oh, right. Like, okay.
Oh, no. Okay. Take it out at the moment.
Okay. Well, it'd be interesting to know if you do listen to music whilst reading, what would be your music of preference? I certainly can't use music when I'm writing, but listening when reading seems to be like a nice... Van Morrison, that's quite good.
Mm.
I'm on a Paul Simon thing at the moment.
Yes, you just saw Paul Simon last night. Yeah.
I've just seen Paul Simon. So this morning, instead of any radio, I just constructed a Paul Simon playlist of what he played. So anyway, let us know. You can email us at any time, booksoftheyear@yahoo.com, and we're on Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Pick Any Page. Right, we're going to talk to Matt Haig in just a second, assuming he's here and not just around the corner. We'll ask him about music too. Yes, very good news. It's time to talk again to Matt Haig. The Midnight Train is out. Matt, it's very nice to see you. How are you?
It's always good to see you guys. And yeah, I'm okay. A bit sleepy, but I've had some caffeine this morning, so it should be kicking in right about now.
Right. We've just been talking. Someone asked us, when we read, do we listen to music? And the listener said they have started listening to classical music. Soft strings is what they like, touch of Mantovani maybe, but not piano. When you're reading, do you like music on?
I generally like some sort of background noise and music in particular because, I mean, I have a bit of ringing in my ears, so I'm not great at silence because I don't really have that. So I like a bit of music. I can't do talk radio, but I like music and... I mean, I don't really have a choice because I've got two teenagers who are at home a lot of the time. So they bring their own noise. And my daughter's quite musical. So she's always playing the piano. She's got a drum kit now.
Oh, that's good.
But actually, drum kits now are the quietest instrument because they have the electronic. Yeah, so they have a little pitter patter.
Noise cancelling headphones, Matt. You know, you can listen to anything that you want.
This is true. Yeah, I'm weird with headphones. I'm not very good at headphones. I don't know why. But.
Sorry, when you say. We will talk about the book. You're not very good at headphones.
No, I'm not very good
at them. You just put them on.
I know you just put them on, but then I'm very conscious that I'm wearing headphones and I can't think anything. I'm a strange neurodiverse person and I just sort of like, I don't know. I just find them strange to have on my head.
Radio's a good format.
Yes. But,
anyway, you're very welcome and it's always good when there's a new Matt Haig book around. The cover's interesting. So Matt Haig can explain more in this moment. But t'other Matt, describe the cover.
So what you've got, as you'd expect for a book called The Midnight Train, most of the book is in sort of midnight bluey black, midnight sky. But right in the centre is it's a sort of rainbow of colours, and it's lighting up a sort of old-fashioned train window. And in the left-hand side of the window, we've got the silhouette of a man and holding up his hand. And in the right-hand side, we've got the silhouette of a woman, but she appears to be fading away, and there's a little moon there in the corner as well. Then the Midnight Train in big, bold white at the top, Matt Haig, the multi-million copy best-selling author at the bottom, and to the left and right of those windows, A Life-Changing Journey, An Unstoppable Love.
Did people vote for this cover? Is that right?
Yeah, but it had to be changed because the windows... at first didn't have the bar between the windows, so they looked like two iPhones.
It's
still got a little bit of that, but more window-like with the bar across. So we had a lot of feedback saying, why is it just a picture of two iPhones on the cover of your book? But we slightly adjusted it to make it
more famous. So was this on Instagram?
Yes. I mean, I'm quite into that. I'm quite into involving like the readers and doing polls. I mean, I can remember with the Midnight Library, I couldn't decide whether it should just be called Midnight Library or The Midnight Library. So I just asked them, and I think it was 66% in favour of having a definite article in the front of it. So, with this one, with things like covers and stuff, I wouldn't change the course of what I'm writing because of what someone says. But once you've written the thing... yeah, I'm not above a bit of polls or focus grouping. I think you've got to have two hats. You've got to have your sort of slightly artistic hat and you're writing what you want to write. And then, you know, if you want a career in this thing, you then have to sort of like think a bit reader-centric and what they'll be wanting.
So you mentioned Midnight Library, and it does say on the cover, as Matt just said, the multi-million copy best-selling author. I'm just emphasising that because it said like 10 million copies.
It's something. Yeah, it was a lot in lots of different places. I mean, that was the nice thing about Midnight Library, seeing its different reactions, like in some places. Like, some places did really well. I mean, France, it didn't do anything. I mean, it's very hard in like France for any British author to do anything. It's interesting. In France, my books are basically marketed as children's books because French literature is seen as, you know, have to be so highbrow and philosophical. So France, we haven't got, but yes, in places like Turkey, Spain, South America, strangely, it did really well in Brazil and Mexico and South Korea because I think a member of BTS K-pop band.
Oh, there you go.
And they just buy everything that they mentioned. So that was just like, whoosh.
So the fact we have the recurring word midnight, to what extent is this, it's not a follow-on, but it's like a spiritual ally? I don't know. I don't know what words to use here.
Sibling. I go with sibling because I feel like it's having a slight argument. It's related, but it's having a slight disagreement with the Midnight Library. It's saying something about life, but it's saying something slightly different. Because I think the Midnight Library, that was a story about acceptance. It was a story about accepting your own life and not, you know, worrying too much about the grass being greener. And, you know, I stand by that. I think that's a good sort of, like, philosophy to have. But I also think as I'm getting older, you know, you're conscious of, like, when you're at the sort of end point and looking back at your life, where will the areas of regret be? What could I be doing differently? You know, who should I be seeing more of? What relationship should I be concentrating on? Am I too ambitious? Am I too focused on work? Those sort of questions. So this is about how would we live if we had the perspective of the future looking back? You know, how could we be nostalgic about the present?
Okay. So just introduce us to your main cast and the main characters that we follow through this.
Well, the main character is called Wilbur Budd. He had a quite impoverished background in Sheffield in the 40s and 50s, and we meet him again as an old man in his 80s on his last day on Earth. And in between, he falls in love with a woman called Maggie Shaw, and a lot of the book is actually, well, quite a bit of the book is set on their honeymoon in Venice. And he's outwardly a very successful man. He's got a chain of bookshops. So he's a sort of like recognized business person. He's been a guest on Dragon's Den. He's kind of like an aspirational figure in some sense, but inwardly he feels quite a failure that he's let things pass by. Chiefly Maggie, his marriage ended, we don't quite know why, and it's about as he goes back through his life on this midnight train from his childhood onwards, he increasingly wants to sort of change the past and sort of make amends, but he can't because otherwise he'd sacrifice eternity if he'd do that. So it's about that dilemma he faces, and, you know, possibly asks the reader as well what they would change and whether they would want to step off their train.
So this is going to be intriguing because everyone can identify with this idea that, you know, if I could go back to that point there, what I'd do is not worry about that, but I would talk to that girl or, yeah, you know, all those kind of things. And it struck me as it, because the events that that you take Wilbur back to, they're not always great.
No.
In fact, there are a number of times where he says, I don't want to get off this train because I know what's coming. I know happens at this particular event.
Yes.
And it struck me as an exquisite kind of torture to tell someone, you're going to watch, knowing what's going to happen, you're going to watch what happened and you're not allowed to intervene. And that's because all of us in that situation go, if you can just do this now, it'll be fine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I wouldn't say, obviously, this isn't necessarily scientifically true, this book, but there is increasing knowledge that at the very end of our lives, there's a massive burst of brain activity. And the part of our brain which comes to life after our heart stops beating is the part to do with memory. So that's given further sort of speculation to the idea that our life really does flash before our eyes at the end of it. So, you know, and I was wondering what, you know, that doesn't necessarily feel as fast as it actually happens. So what if it was kind of like this train journey for our life? And it's kind of terrifying. You know, it's a bittersweet thing. So, yeah, no, it is kind of torture. And that's the torture, certainly in the first half of the novel. He basically is kind of powerless. And, but I think also that makes us all question, because I think we're encouraged more and more in modern society to just be distracted, to not concentrate, just feel a bit unhappy about things we don't really need to be unhappy about, and to therefore buy products. You know, all our natural fears are channeled into marketing and consumerism. So, you know, you have a natural fear of growing older. So that was a multi-billion dollar beauty industry, anti-aging industry that, you know, channels into that. So we're encouraged to sort of deny the process of aging and deny thinking about it. But I think books can be a space where you do think about it. It doesn't have to be a depressing thing. It can be quite an empowering thing to think, okay, this is the life we have, and these are the good old days. These are always the good old days, because there's always a future point we'll be looking back at this point.
Because I remember having a conversation with a friend about time travel and you know, that sort of age-old question of where would you go back to if you had the chance? Yeah. And he said, I would go back to me at 19, and I would tell myself, don't worry about those things, these things, don't worry about her or that or any of these things that are occupying your mind right now. Enjoy this, and this, because in 40 years' time, that's all you'll remember.
Yeah. It's so rarely the case that you're worrying about the right things. With hindsight, when you're looking back, I mean, I was a hypochondriac for many years. I never died of any of the things I was thinking about, I was about to die from. And, you know, it's always the case. I was fortunate in some ways. I wasn't that happy as a teenager. So I don't have, you know, there's people who think, well, I was happiest at 16 or 15. So I don't have that feeling of decline from having this happy childhood. And then, I don't know. I feel like, as well, what I tell myself at a young age is you can't have this life of sort of permanent happiness. Happiness, you know, doesn't mean anything without the shade, without the dark times. You know, I did art history at university, and there's a sort of pretentious art history term, chiaroscuro, which is about the contrast of light and shade. So to make a Renaissance painting feel more spiritual, feel more religious, you know, they'd often have the contrast of the shadow, and then they'd have John the Baptist or the Virgin Mary, you know, looking really sort of like glowing and luminescent. And I feel like life's a bit like that. You kind of need, you know, for those light moments to feel it, you need it to go through some sort of darkness in your life.
There's the woman who is with Wilbur on the train is Agnes, who used to run the bookshop, which he eventually takes over. But anyway, she is the character that sits with him, tells him the rules. And she says something, and I wrote it down just because it sounded like a very un-Matt Haig thing to write.
Okay.
She says, sometimes happiness has the least to teach us. Because he's saying, can we spend more time here because life is good? I don't want to go and spend all the time through the bad times.
Yeah.
But do you think that sometimes happiness has the least to teach us? Is that what... Is that just Agnes, or is that...
I think so. I mean, like, I love happiness. I like being happy. Everyone likes being happy. But I feel like, you know, the lessons, like what you draw on. I think Graham Greene said something about it. He said, like, a miserable childhood is the bank a writer draws from for the rest of their life. You know what I mean? You go back to it and you sort of pull on it. And he was quite a miserable writer. But I do love Graham Greene, but he was miserable. But, so it's always... I don't know. There's more inspiration from it. But it's not necessarily to depress people with that information or to depress yourself. Sometimes that moment of recovering from something, from a situation. So it's not happiness, but you're sort of getting yourself out of the unhappiness. That's where a real lesson can be learned. You know, and that's, you know, when I wrote about the... my mental health with Reasons to Stay Alive, it was always about, you know, starting in the bad place and then sort of like... going upwards from there.
Because, I mean, you mentioned that book, and we've spoken before about it.
Yeah,
about
definitely.
That book, you know, going back many years. And there's a section in Midnight Train where we're with Wilbur on the roof of Park Hill Rise Flats, 13 floors up, and he's deciding whether to jump. And I remember from our previous conversation that you had a very similar experience, that you were on the top of the cliffs deciding whether to jump.
Yeah, when I was 24 years old, I nearly died by suicide. I nearly threw myself off cliffs. I ended up in a Spanish hospital because my girlfriend was terrified. And I went through years. That was a moment, but I went through years of sort of like suicidal thinking, agoraphobia, panic disorder. Not really getting the help I needed. I didn't have therapy at that point. I called a few hotlines, and I was prescribed diazepam, which didn't really help me. And so I went through that, and I went quite the long, hard, winding way through that. And obviously it leaks out into the fiction. You know, a lot more of that experience leaks into my fiction than some of the sort of happier times. I think I'm seen as quite a sort of positive, uplifting writer.
Definitely.
But there's always some sort of like darkness there. I feel like the challenge for a writer, well, for me, when I'm writing, is to try and find some authentic optimism. Because, you know, it's easy to have fake optimism. It's also easy, I think, to be quite depressing. Certainly for me, I'd find it very easy. And when I was younger, I did write some very depressing books. I wrote a book called The Possession of Mr. Cave, which is just so depressing. And I wouldn't encourage anyone to read it. And it just makes you miserable. And everyone dies in it. And I was quite depressed writing it. I feel like, you know, we're very cynical in this country, aren't we, about optimism, about writing books that are useful. You know, the whole term self-help is basically an insult. But, you know, if you can find something authentically hopeful, you know, that's what we all want. I mean, that's why people go to a therapist. That's what, you know, we're all after some sort of comfort and consolation.
Well, that's why Reasons to Stay Alive was such a great title, because, first of all, it's positive and optimistic, but clearly in the title it says, because you've been questioning that. So what's that art history phrase you just mentioned, light and shade?
Chiaroscuro.
There you go. Well, that's the perfect chiaroscuro title.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Because that says you're in that immediate moment. Most people aren't going around thinking, oh, what's my reason to stay alive today? You're thinking of that when you're in the sort of moment of crisis, and so depression has a sort of philosophical side to it, because you're literally in that Hamlet sort of state of mind of am I going to live or not.
As you mentioned at the start there, so Wilbur is in his 80s when we're first sort of introduced to him, and it struck me as interesting that you clearly decided to have this. So he's obviously in his 80s, therefore born just as World War II is coming to a close, and that struck me as because you're not. And I wondered, because surely the temptation must have been for you to write this as someone who's about my age, so therefore, you know, the cultural references, the things like that as they're growing up, I'll be able to get those straight away. Whereas you've clearly made a decision, no, I want to have Wilbur and Maggie be from a generation much older than me.
Yeah, I don't know why, actually. Yeah, it could have been a 1980s novel and 1990s, and I could have been listening to Simon Mayo on the radio.
There you go. Yeah.
That's right.
Still there, by the way.
Pops. I mean, that might make you depressed. I was having such a good time, and then I turned the radio on.
No.
I immediately went into a slough of despond.
Yeah, I don't know why. But I feel like, well, the Sheffield aspect of the 1960s, that comes from my parents, because my parents were quite like Wilbur and Maggie. They met at university in Sheffield in the 1960s. Well, my mum was teacher training college. My dad was studying architecture. And the way they talked about the 60s in Sheffield is quite interesting, because I think most people think of like northern towns in the 60s as a sort of flat cap, you know, working class stereotype. And my mum and dad talked about it. I mean, might as well have been talking about Carnaby Street. They talked about Art College. They talked about Malcolm X coming on a tour. They talked about, you know, multiculturalism. There were soul clubs. There were jazz clubs. It was this vibrant city. It was a big art college there. And I feel like that's not, you know, you don't often get that. You get London a lot in that sort of era, but you don't get that side of the north, and to show that it was just more than Carnaby Street and the King's Road, and there was this stuff happening elsewhere in the country. That was quite an incentive to write that. And I don't know why. I've always been quite a nostalgic person. I can remember in the 1980s just wishing I lived in the 1960s. I don't remember, you know, if you remember, like, there was a massive sort of Beach Boys revival. There was that sort of greatest hits of the Beach Boys in about 1987 or something. And so I can remember just being in the 80s, being obsessed with the Doors, the Beach Boys, Beatles, you know, wanting to be back there.
I'm
sure you'll have seen this, but it was a very remarkable quote that Ian Rankin came up with recently. He was speaking on another podcast. I mean, I didn't know that there was
Imagine.
One, and he said, and this I'm paraphrasing here, but that he had wasted his life living with fictional characters. I mentioned this because wasting your life on the wrong things is sort of one of the themes that you're looking at. You know, don't do that, do this. And he said he wasted his life living with fictional characters. He has no memory of some major life events because his mind was elsewhere. So he actually was this is my interpretation, he was at his kid's speech day or sports day or something, but his mind was working out plot, working out character.
I'd say a lot of people can relate to that, but not necessarily thinking of Ian Rankin novels. They're just on their phone. So it's probably better to be having your mind on Rebus than it is on whatever you're looking at on Instagram. But yeah, I mean, I relate to that, and I relate to sort of, but I was always like that. I was always a daydreamer. I mean, in some subjects at school, I was bracketed as special needs, and that was basically because I wasn't concentrating and I wasn't on what I was meant to be on. So I think I'm instinctively like that. So I try not to beat myself up too much about that. I've just got the sort of mind that's always somewhere else. But I do, you know, I do regret, certainly, like when my kids were little, that was at the point my career started to take off. So my mind inevitably went into worries and thinking about work all the time, as it does to a lot of people when they're in the 30s. And I was very ambitious. And, you know, I now realise, you know, I should have had a little bit more focus on that. But you can't, you know, go back and retrofit it and do that. But
because I think if you could see inside, say you go to a sports day or any kind of school event, and you look at the pair, or watching a football match or whatever it is, that, you know, there'll be, and I'm making up these figures, obviously, 20% are fully engaged, 50% are thinking about what they're supposed to be doing this afternoon, worried about have I got enough petrol, have I got enough food in, is my other son about to lose his job, you know, all those kind of things. Everyone's mind is everywhere all the time, which is why I thought Ian was beating himself up a little bit too much.
Well, that's what writers do, isn't it? You just beat yourself up. I mean, you've met a lot of writers, haven't you? And you've written yourself. And writing is a fundamentally introspective activity. I think when they've done those silly polls of the happiest and unhappiest jobs, like happiest job is hairdresser because you're having sort of conversations all the time with new people. Unhappiest job is often... well, writers somewhere in there, because, you know, you're going inward, you're not having a thing. But I feel like, you know, I don't want to be too deep about it, but I feel like writing is a kind of socialising. It's just a kind of deeper, like, Ian Rankin is kind of having a conversation. He's communicating, isn't he? So when he's writing, he's not necessarily talking to someone in the room, but he is communicating, and people reading a novel are... listening to that writer and having their own conversations with them. So I feel like it's a kind of communication. It's just a different...
So that's it's strange, because that goes straight to something that I was going to ask you about, which is when Wilbur's talking about him and his friend Charlie. And just reading a direct quote from the book, it says, "In knowing Charlie, it became clear that a big reason books and comics and films and music exist is to give people a way to talk about things without talking about them." So to Simon's point about, you know, the idea that Ian Rankin would be wasting his time with fictional characters, or those of us who adore his books would be wasting our time reading about fictional characters, I would go to chin to chin with Ian Rankin on that and say, absolutely not. This is a way we learn about each other.
And also, Ian, as you know, is such a nice guy, and he's such a personable guy, and he's so easy to communicate with people. And I feel like, you know, he's not that writer stereotype of a real miserable, you know. I can think of others who are much more that, misanthropic. But I think, yeah, he's possibly being a bit harsh on it, but himself, but I can relate to that too. The thing that frustrates me about Ian Rankin, I saw this documentary about his planning process, and I suppose thriller writers have to be like this, and I'm so jealous of writers who can plan to the extent that thriller writers have to plan, I suppose. What I find difficult about first draft is writing it all down before I forget it. So I rush it. It's very garbled. You know, every sentence starts with "and then." It's like a six-year-old coming in to tell the story. "And then so-and-so did this in the park." And then. It's always like, this rush to the end.
So you just write. It's like sort of stream of consciousness.
That's when I am really antisocial. And my wife will say, Matt, and she'll have to say it about seven times and get really cross because I'm right there, but I'm just, my mind's just trying to finish the book.
You mentioned the French being very French about your books and thinking of them that they're just kids' books. But do you think that you would have written this book if you hadn't been a children's writer? Well, I mean, did that give you a kind of a different way of approaching a, this is an adult book, you know, yeah, with some grown up ideas, but do you think your heritage as someone who wrote for kids is in there?
I think I've learnt more from writing for children than I have for adults. So I feel like, and I know you've written for children too, and I feel like children are better readers in some ways. You know, they don't have the vocab, and there's things that you can't write about, obviously, for good reason, for children. But their imaginations, they go with a story easier. Like, you know, they not might not necessarily believe in unicorns, but you can throw a unicorn in a story with, for a child, and they will go with that. They go with the dream easier, and we lose that. So I think for when you're writing for adults, if you sort of like, write for the child they were, you know, write, you know, and that's one of the reasons I chose a train, because instantly when you've got an old sort of steam train in a book, you're back in the railway children, you're back in the Polar Express, you're back in that sort of childhood feeling, because originally first draft of this book was very sort of sci-fi and quite cold, and it had no train in it at all. It was called The Memory Thief, and it was AI. It was a sort of critique of AI, because basically at the end of Wilbur's life, he'd paid for software that could help him relive his life without him knowing he was sort of paying for software. And then when he was on honeymoon in Venice, Venice started disappearing. So it was very Black Mirror-ish, trying to be a bit Christopher Nolan. And but it, for me, it was quite, the characters were quite cold and I wasn't feeling it. So adding a steam train in, thinking I was sort of writing a kind of capital S story, like you would a children's story, it helped it. And I find, you know, they almost use, like when people say, oh, it's like a children's book, it's sometimes used as a bit of an insulting thing, but I actually see it as a compliment. I try and use simple words and simple language and, you know, something that feels a bit more universal and childlike.
Yeah, and if the French don't get it, then more.
Yeah, exactly. We don't, and we'll have to be Jean-Paul Sartre.
So I wrote down Grapes of Wrath, John Steinbeck, because it is mentioned specifically. Yeah. Is it Wilbur's favourite book?
Yes.
It's the book that he wants to talk about the most. Now, you wouldn't have picked that without that being a favourite of yours. I mean, not a particularly controversial choice, but what was the, why did you pick that?
But he's quite unfashionable now, isn't he, John Steinbeck? I don't think any sort of young person's reading John. I think because it was on the, Of Mice and Men, wasn't it, on the GCSE syllabus for so many years, it just became one of those. But so in my mind, he became this sort of dry, boring author without me really reading him. But like The Grapes of Wrath is a book, I think it was 1930s, but it fits now in so many ways. The themes are humans in the sort of economics of technology and, you know, recession and depression, and it's a migration story, and, you know, there's so many themes which resonate today. And John Steinbeck was a radical writer. He was a socialist writer. You could clearly, you know, people always say, oh, you shouldn't see an author's politics in a book, but you could clearly see John Steinbeck's politics in his books. And yeah, he was quite a radical, but he's become seen as quite safe and stuff. So yeah, I was trying to sort of like put that in there as a book with very human values, as Wilbur starts to lose his sort of human values.
Listeners may well have seen some, we mentioned Midnight Library at the start of our conversation, the fact that it's, you got Florence Pugh. No, I don't think you go.
I'm just so scared of talking about it because I never know what I'm allowed to say. But yes, it was announced last week that Florence Pugh is going to be in the film, and we've known this for some time. But you know, you have this sort of strict thing where you can't make it official. But apparently, yes, it has gone official last week, and it's very exciting. And
she's amazing in everything.
She's amazing in everything. And for those that haven't read The Midnight Library, she's going to be, you know, so right for this part, because Nora lives so many different lives. So there's so many opportunities to play different types of characters within the same character. So she's, you know, going to be an Olympian, a rock star, all these different things. And I think she, you know, she's probably the most versatile actress of that age. So I think, she's going to be great.
You do realise what's coming down the track there, don't you? To use the train analogy.
Go on.
It's a midnight trilogy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you can't, nothing. There's no one. No one wants a pair of midnight books, but a trilogy.
It would look Yes, possibly. But I need to have a story. I need to have
just crowbar it in. The Midnight Sandwich.
The Midnight Sandwich. Well, I want to go anyway. Something aspirational, but Midnight Luxury Hotel. But yeah. because it's called The Midnight Train, my publisher did an event on there's a old 1920s train which leaves Victoria Station about four times a week, and they do a little circle and you have a nice time. It's not quite the Orient Express, but it's heading that direction. And so we had an event on that train. And I was thinking, I just need to do another aspirational thing. The Midnight Palace.
I think the Midnight Magic, Midnight Movie.
The Midnight Movie.
Midnight Cinema. There you go. That'd be a wonderful thing.
Yeah, the Midnight Book. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't.
It's going to happen. Anyway. I'm just saying, your publisher's outside. She is definitely agreeing with me. That it's going to be a Midnight Trilogy. But for the moment, we content ourselves with a brand new book from Matt Hagen. It's called The Midnight Train. We will have some further conversation with Matt in a few days' time with our Q&A. But for the moment, Matt Hagen, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, guys.